This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. You know, we talk about a lot of different things on Main Street, just like we do on any Main Street, for that matter, because we are curious people, and sometimes we're curious about the lives of people who live elsewhere. And today we're going to explore that a bit through the help of the Episcopal Diocese of North Dakota. I'm joined in our studio in Bismarck by Andrea Stomberg. She is the chair of the Haitian Outreach Committee for the Episcopal Diocese. Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
And with you, Asenel Laurent. He's a Haitian journalist and a tour operator in his home country. Asenel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, though.
The Episcopal Church will hold its annual North Dakota Convention Friday and Saturday in Bismarck, Andrea. What is the church's mission in Haiti?
Well, it's a very small mission. We do have done outreach internationally for a number of years and kind of just wrapped up a mission in Guatemala that was a medical mission. So there's been a little energy put towards Haiti. And we cast about a little bit as to where we should focus, but we have kind of joined hands with the Episcopal Diocese of Milwaukee, who has a 30-year-plus relationship with a parish church and health clinic in the little town of Jeannette, which is a very rural area on the southern claw of Haiti. And so we've been able to partner with them to, for instance, build latrines, to work on things that the school need in terms of physical plant, as well as to work with the health clinic and doing some healthcare outreach in the community that has all been funded through the Diocese of North Dakota.
Asenel, what's your role here?
Yes, I work in a project that calls Green School, Clean School. Green School, Clean School has the support of HP, that means Haiti Project, and I come just to talk to the convention of diocese, just to explain to people the work that we are doing and the support that they give to us, what we have done with that money, and how we impacted people's life.
How would you describe the condition of your country these days?
And this is very tough and very difficult. There's a lot going on, and, you know, we are tough people, and we're trying just to get things done, you know.
Well, you're a tour operator and a journalist. Can you kind of describe how you what your life is like?
Yes, that's a busy life, like every day, like busy for me, because I have to handle stuff with the Green School, Clean School project. And at the same time, I have to, if I have visitors, if I have tourists coming to visit, I have to handle this. And also doing my show, I don't do the show like every day. I do it twice a week on Thursday, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. and Monday. We have 3 hours where people could come talk about various topics, and also we could have guests coming to our studio, and we also play music in the show. And for our business, like tourism business, we every month we have a program. We travel with people across the Caribbean. We often have a trip to Cuba, Mexico. And we also have a trip to Russia during the World Cup. And now we have, I think in 2 weeks, we're going to have a trip to Cuba with about 16 people. And this is what we do. And we also host people. We welcome people in Haiti. We work with people from different countries. And especially Andrea and I, we trying to put together a trip on January where we could bring people from Bismarck and North Dakota to Haiti to go to visit this country and learn about his history, because we have a lot to say, to tell to people around the world. And even if the situation is really tough, but there's a lot of interesting things that people could go and see in Haiti. So.
Well, it's fun to talk with another radio guy. Andrea, this Green School project, what makes that attractive to your organization?
Well, Haiti is a country that is struggles with food security. And the farming is I don't want to call it primitive, but it's garden farming. People have their own little plots, and they raise their plants sometimes not as effectively as they could. And for instance, there was a thought that you couldn't grow eggplant in this area. Well, through the Clean School Green School program, they realized they can grow really great eggplants in this area. So it was introducing some vegetables that hadn't been grown for a while. But particularly, it's great to get the kids involved. They grow the plants from seed. They plant them. They take care of them. And then when they harvest them, it goes into their school lunches. So that was such a nice integrated program. And we had the land there at the school, and the kids just love it. There's 550 children at this school. So there's a lot of little bodies that like to get their hands dirty.
Well, somebody who's from where you're from, visiting a place like Haiti, what's that impression like for you?
You know, Haiti is such a country. It's a beautiful country. It's a crowded country. The people are so kind. I've never been treated better, really. And it's a very easy place, especially once you get out. I mean, Port-au-Prince is a really challenging place because it's big and busy and dirty and really noisy and the traffic's terrible. But you get into rural Haiti, and it's just a delightful place to be. Not that it's not without its problems.
Asanel, how important is tourism to Haiti's economy?
Yes, it is really important because we part of the Caribbean, and today millions of people visiting the Caribbean, like Dominican Republic, who share the same island with Haiti, they receive more than 7 million people, which is more than 30% of the economy. And in the past, Haiti was one of the first country in the Caribbean to receive tourists from all over the world. And because of the political situation, it's like decreased. And we believe if we want to reconstruct this country, tourism is a very important part. And how we could, the same way like Cuba, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and other countries having at least 2 million people coming visiting Haiti, it could help people living next to the sites to have a little economy, which could help them to send their kids to school and also buying the stuff that they need to live. So I think it is really, 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 really important, and this is the reason why I always talk in my show about tourism, how we could, you know, invest more in tourism in Haiti and how we could attract more people to come and visit so that more people could have the chance to get a job.
Well, you're talking about a country that's been the bullseye for a lot of awful natural disasters for several years now. I mean, in 2010, there was that terrible earthquake that may have killed hundreds of thousands of people. There's a cholera epidemic. There have been hurricanes. Just earlier this month, there was another earthquake that killed a dozen people and injured many more. Is Haiti ready for people to return? Because you've had quite a few Haitians leave.
Yes, I think we are ready. And at the same time, I think that we have to work to make things change. We have to, build our building in a way that it could resist to earthquakes, like you said. And Andrea has given you a picture of Haiti. Port-au-Prince is like crowded and noisy and having a lot of people. But there's the other cities in Haiti where, you know, people are friendly, beautiful. And I think that we could sell to the world this part of Haiti where there's a lot of beautiful beaches, like in the south part of Haiti. The north, we have the Citadel, one of the biggest fortresses in the Americas. And I think, yes, we have a very difficult situation. And at the same time, I think we should not step down because this thing happened to us. We have to step up and, you know, go forward just to make change happening.
The 48th Annual Convention of the Episcopal Diocese of North Dakota begins on Friday at noon and continues on Saturday and adjourns in the afternoon on Saturday. And the Haiti Mission Workshop is on the afternoon on Friday. Andrea, how many people do you expect to attend this convention?
This year there'll be about 100 people. We have 20 churches throughout North Dakota. Some of them are very, very small. But, yeah, everybody will have representation there, and there's about 100 folks that
and
will attend.
At this convention, is that where you make the decisions about, you know, working with this mission in Haiti?
Generally, in terms of putting the budget forward and getting that approved, so that obviously is key to our work. But, yeah, it's just good to sit there and talk to people and try to encourage them to come and just get some more excitement about the work we're doing there.
And how supportive are people to, you know, help folks that they'll never meet and live in a faraway place?
I am always so amazed at how generous people are. Just, you know, gifts come unasked for. People come up and say, here's, they may not have much money, but they'll give me $5 or $10. I'm always amazed at how generous people are.
Asanel, you've been busy meeting with church groups talking about this green school project in Haiti that you are supportive of. What's your next stop on your tour?
That's going to be a fairly long trip. And I have to say that I was in Miami for a while, in Wisconsin, Madison. Now in Chicago, I am in Bismarck, and I will go to New York and maybe in Connecticut. And I have to talk to the dean of the school that I attended in Rhode Island University. I could stay for a while and after go back to Miami and Haiti.
All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Asanel Laurent is a Haitian journalist and tour operator, and Andrea Stomberg is the chair of the Haitian Outreach Committee for the Episcopal Diocese of North Dakota. Again, their annual convention gets underway tomorrow at noon at the Bismarck Radisson and continues through Saturday. You can find out more about the diocese and its work at ndepiscopal.org. Coming up next on Main Street, the Metropolitan Opera holds auditions in Grand Forks.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Museum of Art, featuring Walter Peel Retrospective, covering 56 years of paintings and drawings, plus Barton Ladici Benish's New York apartment in the mezzanine gallery, lunch at the Museum Cafe, and handmade items in the gift shop. Learn more at ndmoa.com.
Next on Playing on Air, the mystery at Twickenham Vicarage.
Oh, dear. I say, I have 3 bullet holes in my cummerbund. I seem to have been shot.
Yes, Jerry, I'm afraid there's been a bit of a shutting accident.
A what?
A shutting accident.
Oh, shutting accident.
Next on Playing on Air, great American short plays on radio and podcast.
Playing on Air, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Royce Blackburn. He is an associate professor of music at the University of North Dakota. He joins us from our microphone on campus. Royce, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We are talking about the 55th annual North Dakota Manitoba District Auditions for the Metropolitan Opera. It's been going on a long time in Grand Forks, Royce.
Yes, we've had 55 years of uninterrupted competitions here, and it's really quite a treasure for both Grand Forks and North Dakota.
Well, I'm thinking it must be a feather in the cap for the university, too, since it's on campus.
It is. I think it does attract an arts audience to campus that loves classical music and loves singers, and that's always a good thing for anyone.
How are these auditions conducted? They're coming up this Saturday at the Hughes Fine Arts Center on UND's campus, and incidentally, they're free and open to the public, but how are they conducted?
Well, singers from across the nation and even Canada can apply to enter through the Metropolitan Opera, and then they choose their district where they want to go. Now, mostly we get local folks or people nearby, but we have people from as far away as Texas and New Jersey and Saskatchewan and British Columbia, I think, this year. And they'll come to town probably tomorrow night, spend the night here. And then at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, they will sing. They have a list of 5 arias, and they will choose one of them. And the judges will choose a second one. And the judges are a panel of 3 internationally respected judges that we request. We ask them to come in for us, and they have always been generous and said yes. And they determine who's going to be the winner of the district level. And that person will then go on to the regional level in Minneapolis in March, I think, this year.
How many districts are there?
41, and I think we just added one, so it might be 42. 42 districts and 13 regions.
And how many people are you expecting to show up for the 55th annual North Dakota Manitoba district auditions?
Well, it's a record for us. We have 17 singers, and barring untoward weather, which I think is going to be a beautiful day, they'll all show up. I hope they will. And our audiences have been growing over the past years, so we're closing in on about 125 to 150 audience members.
And they'll get a treat here. They'll see an actual opera audition, right?
Absolutely. It's really what it is. It's an audition for an audience and for the judges. Normally, you're just singing in a room with a panel of judges to decide if you get a job or not. And this is a little bit different, a little more concert-oriented.
Yeah, you can play to the crowd a bit, huh?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And and we do have an Audience Choice Award. You have to stay all day, so you have to see all the singers. But you get to choose your favorite artist, and that person receives an Audience Choice Award plus a monetary prize.
Now, do these people who are auditioning in the district auditions, have to pass some other hurdle before they get here? I mean, you said they applied through the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah, well, they do have to be qualified, but we have to leave that, unfortunately, up to them.
Uh-huh.
Well, not unfortunately. Most of the people we get are thoroughly qualified to do this. There have been a few years, but lately we have had extraordinary singers. I mean, just a wonderful day of singing and music making.
Well, I am intrigued by this approach where they have these arias, one of which they get to pick and another one mm-hmm. that the judges will assign
select,
them.
Yep.
So mm-hmm. are we talking about their sight reading this one? Or?
Oh, no. They've learned and prepared these arias excruciatingly well.
Okay, so they pick one of the five they want to do, and then the judges
yep.
pick another one they will do.
You got it.
Okay.
You got it. And sometimes it's a surprise sometimes you see a little look of surprise on the singer's face. Oh, you chose that one? Okay.
Okay, because everybody's got a certain range, I suppose. You know, you're a baritone or you're a soprano.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. Who are the judges?
The judges this year are Dean Williamson, and he is the music director of the Nashville Opera. And we have Laurie Rogers, who is the director of the Sarasota Young Artist Program, and we have Roger Maloof, who has retired from being an assistant conductor at the Metropolitan Opera in New York.
Wow, this is a prestigious group of judges you've got here.
Very much so. These people know their business.
And how do you get them?
Well, we call around.
Okay.
we start asking and frankly sometimes begging, would you please come to North Dakota on a cold winter's day? We've tried to move the auditions up into October so that we beat some of the weather.
Okay.
We were getting a little worried last week.
Well, the auditioners and the audience, but the auditioners in particular, get an extra special treat because these judges are offering master classes too.
Yeah, we have two master classes this year. We've been offering two master classes, one on Friday night for UND students and area high school students that are interested to come, as well as a master class on Saturday after the auditions for any of the participants or auditioners that want to stay and work with the judge. This year, Dean Williamson will be doing the Saturday afternoon class, and Roger Maloof will be doing the Friday evening class.
And these master classes are also free and open to the public.
You can stay as long as you like.
Okay. What happens in an opera master class?
Well, often a student will come and sing a song for the clinician or for the master teacher, and what they're looking for is to have that master teacher offer them advice on how to perform better, perhaps it's a technical issue about breathing or about the range or something like that, or it could be a language issue. We need to try to pronounce this a little differently, and it's always going to the goal of crafting a more honed and expert and professional performance.
And you've got some returning winners coming this year.
We do. Elsa Swanson was one of our winners last year, and she is back, and she is a wonderful singer. And Jessica Coe-Switcher is coming back as well. She was one of our winners 2 years ago.
So what is the prize, if you will, for the auditions for the Metropolitan Opera?
Well, they win a cash award. If the winners receive a cash award of $1,000 apiece, and we also have encouragement awards at $500 for younger singers or singers that the judges think, you know, this person is really good. They're just not quite ready to move on to this level of the competition yet.
So how many winners are there?
There can be usually two, and as many as two absolute winners. Sometimes we've had three. And Encouragement Award winners, we've had upwards of two or three. And, of course, we have the Audience Choice Award, too.
And, of course, the winners, I guess, go on to the regional, right, in Minneapolis.
Yes, sir, they do.
And ultimately, this must go to some final national competition. And what happens, and where is that?
Well, from the regional levels, they will choose one or two singers in each of the regions, sometimes three, but that's frankly rare. And then they go on to the national semifinals at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And from the national semifinals, it's a long process. From the national semifinals, there will be a grand finals concert on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera with the Met Opera Orchestra.
Good heavens.
it's quite pressurized. And then from there, they'll choose, it's been in the past years, five or six winners from there.
Well, of course, when we think of opera, we think of big voice, big room.
So
describe the Hughes Fine Arts Center for our listeners.
Well, the lovely thing about the Hughes Fine Arts Center, you don't have to have a telescope to watch the singers. It's a room of about 200 people, and it's got great acoustics for the voice, so the judges can tell right away, is this a voice that can carry well in a bigger hall?
Mm-hmm.
They're singing with a piano, but it's an intimate setting for the audience, and which is terrific because they get to see the singers up close and personal, and they get to know them a little bit, which is a nice thing, I think.
Now, is opera, professional opera, now mic'd these days, or is it still the big voice filling the big room?
It is still the big voice filling the big room. There are occasionally operas where they will perhaps mic the singers, but generally that is for the purposes of understanding the text, more so than saying, well, we have to put a mic on you or we'll never hear you. If you're in that boat, you probably didn't get the job.
Speaking of which, a lot of operas are, of course, in other languages. So,
yep.
So
mm-hmm.
Are the judges looking for, the proper pronunciation and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, well, and of course, every judge brings their own qualifications. It's kind of like, I just want to hear a pretty voice. I want to hear great musicianship. Everything's got to be perfect. It all depends on who the person is. Most of these experts, though, are looking for a well-crafted performance in every aspect of what the singer brings to the stage.
And, of course, it's not just singing. I mean, they're performing. They're portraying emotion. They're telling a story, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're looking for somebody who can connect with the audience and who can, like you said, tell a story. It's one of the things that is really, really crucial to opera, particularly because it's in a foreign language.
You mentioned these two returning winners, Jessica Coase-Witcher and Elsa Swanson.
Mm-hmm.
How successful have winners of the district auditions been in pursuing their professional careers?
Many of them have gone on to just fabulous results. One of our winners, Christopher Kenny, this was back in 2014. He was one of the winners here along with Lida Shkwarek, and he has gone on to be a young artist at the Santa Fe Opera, which is probably the largest summer opera program, as well as Washington National Opera in D.C. And now he's a young artist in the Ryan Young Artist Program in Chicago, and he's just been signed by a major international agency, which is terrific. And Lida as well has gone on to terrific success all across Canada. She's just, her career is taking off like just wildfire.
Well, if folks are in Grand Forks on Friday and Saturday especially, at 11 o'clock in the morning, the 55th annual North Dakota Manitoba District Auditions for the Metropolitan Opera take place in front of an audience, and it's free and open to the public. It takes place at Hughes Fine Arts Center on the campus of UND. Royce Blackburn, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and helping us promote this to the community.
Royce is an associate professor of music at UND. Still to come on Main Street, we'll have another Plainsfolk essay from Tom Eastern. Sue Balcom of the Root Cellar Farm near Mandan will join us to talk about food, and we'll talk about our What's Happening calendar of things to do this weekend. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Kansas Small Business Development Center is partnering with the North Dakota Small Business Development Center on a cybersecurity program.
55% of the attacks that are happening these days are levied against small businesses.
Brian Dennis directs the Cybersecurity Center for the Kansas Center.
80% of the cyber attacks that happen because of us, because we as users allowed an attack to happen. Whether that attack is a ransomware that we unfortunately might have opened an email and clicked on a link, or perhaps a phishing attack. attack, where we might have given away information unwittingly and unknowingly.
Dennis says there are simple things small businesses can do to protect themselves. He says it could be as simple as having better passwords and changing them more often.
What's still the number one password in the country? It's password. You know, and so making simple changes, like ensuring that your employees and yourself, you have really good passwords that you're changing often.
Dennis was in Bismarck to talk to small businesses about a threat assessment tool the Kansas Center has developed and how businesses can protect themselves from cyber threats. A Jamestown teen was injured after striking the passenger side of a car with a bicycle Wednesday evening near the middle school. Jamestown Police Major Justin Blinsky says just after 5 p.m., a vehicle driven by a 26-year-old woman was stopped at the intersection of 2nd Avenue Southeast and 3rd Street.
The driver stated she looked both ways and proceeded to make a right turn to go west onto 3rd Street. As she made the turn, there was a bike that was traveling eastbound on the north sidewalk, which parallels 3rd Street. Bicyclist saw the vehicle turning, but the bike that he was operating did not have any brakes on it.
Blinsky says instead of trying to swerve behind the vehicle, the teen tried to go in front and struck the passenger side of the car. He says the teen was taken by ambulance to the Jamestown Regional Medical Center.
The bicyclist sustained non-life-threatening injuries. He was transported to the Jamestown Regional Medical Center for medical treatment for those injuries. Again, they appear to be non-life-threatening at this time.
Blinsky says the incident remains under investigation. He says bikes are not allowed on pedestrian sidewalks, and that is also being taken into consideration. And Grand Forks is seeing some success from a pilot program designed to curb the growing gull and geese population at the city's sewage lagoons. The city has enlisted the services of the USDA and Arium Analytics to assist in mitigation during migration. Waterworks Director Melanie Parvey says the Calgary-based company uses a real-life-looking roe bird.
It's a drone, but it looks like a peregrine falcon, so a female falcon that actually hunts the gulls.
Parvey says the goal is to reduce bird strikes at the nearby Grand Forks Airport.
Last year, this time, we had about 13,000 gulls. In a day's time frame, now we're seeing about 2,000 to 3,000. So we know that what we're doing has had a positive effect, working closely with the landfill to make sure that anything that we do doesn't negatively impact them and vice versa.
In 2016 and 2017, the Grand Forks Airport reported 20 and 24 strikes, respectively, from the end of July to the beginning of October. This year, only two strikes have occurred. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a historian, an author, and a teacher. He's a distinguished professor of history at NDSU, but the middle part of that description, the word author, is vitally important because that's how he shares what he's learned with people outside of his classroom. Today, Tom narrates his Plains Folk essay titled Print Culture.
Here are two images that may seem incongruous, but I'm about to link them. First, driving into Ellendale Sunday afternoon, we espy at the corner of Main and 281 a sandwich sign on wheels, the kind they use for posting notice of a ball game upcoming on a summer night. The sign reads, Book Fair at the Opera House, 2 o'clock to 5 today, free and open to the public. Second, and here I'm getting a little professor wonky. I'm going to cite a book I make my graduate students read by the historian Benedict Anderson, entitled Imagined Communities, Reflections on the Origin and Spread of Nationalism. You see, I told you this would get a little professor wonky. But anyway, Professor Anderson identifies the elements that made it possible for nations to emerge with national identities in the modern world. Central to the making of a constructive identity is what we call a print culture. A nation, a community, a people needs writers, publishers, hard copy in print in order to rally and ground its constituents. Books, periodicals, newspapers, print culture. Which brings us back to Ellendale on a Sunday afternoon. They have a lot of fine cultural events at the historic Opera House in Ellendale. This book fair was chiefly organized by our friend Ken Schmier, with support from Humanities North Dakota. To his and our delight, it was standing room only. I say our delight because I was carrying bags and boxes for my wife, Dr. Suzanne Kelly, editor of North Dakota State University Press, who was MC for the afternoon. I had a speaking part, bottom of the order, for a lineup of 12 authors. What would I say in the bottom of the ninth for such an affair? It was Sunday, so I preached. I said, at this point in my life, approaching my appointed 70, and at this time in the history of the Great Plains, there are three things that matter to me in our public life. The first is country. I use that term in the sense by which I have learned to use it in Australia, meaning land invested with human experience. Space becomes place, land becomes country, when watered by tears of joy and sorrow. In my country, these Great Plains, I attend to the details of the landscape. Second, heritage. When we reflect on our experience here, when we make landmarks on the country, when we tell stories about it, that is, when we become conscious of it and make something of it, then we have a heritage, which is essential to community. Community is my third touchstone. Community is grounded in country, and it is defined by heritage, shared experience. And community in the modern world requires a thriving print culture. So I close with a shout to our authors who mostly labor in isolation and seldom are subjects on sandwich boards. To our publishers, anchors of the moral economy of community building. To our print journalists, most esteemed members of the Fourth Estate. To our independent booksellers who serve as nodes of print culture and prairie community. Zanbro's, Main Street Books, Books on Broadway, Ferguson's, Western Edge. You know who you are. Long may you thrive and serve.
That's Tom Ezern. Next on Main Street, Sue Belcom talks about root crops.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to the author Joseph J. Ellis about his new book, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us.
No historian of the early national period of American life has done more than Joseph Ellis to get us a sense of what it was like then, what were the challenges, what were the opportunities.
So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and by our microphone in Bismarck, Sue Belcom. It's time to talk about some food.
Sue joins us once a week. She is a farmer and a farmer's market aficionado with the Root Cellars Farm just outside of Mandan. Sue, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Nothing says fall like root crops.
Well, you know, it is the season of frost, light or heavy, it's going to come. And root crops, you know, kind of like seasonal eating, your garden starts out kind of light in the spring with things like lettuce and peas and radishes. And as the season progresses, things get a little heavier. So if you belong to a CSA, which is a community-supported ag program, where you receive a box of vegetables every week, you will see how they continue to get heavier and heavier and heavier until we're up to the end of September and October where we have a frost. And then we start getting into things like beets and carrots and potatoes and those kinds of squash crops that you can actually leave out that are frost tolerant. They will get sweeter and much better tasting after the frost.
Why do they get sweeter after the frost? Do you know?
I don't know. It's something cellular in there that kind of like brings out the sugar in things. So when you're storing, let's say, potatoes, you don't want to put the potatoes in the refrigerator when you buy them because the starches kind of like freeze up a little bit. So if you want them to be sweeter, you'll want to bring them out and let them sit on your counter a couple days to kind of like reactivate whatever it is that happens in there with those complex carbohydrates.
So if it's a root crop like a beet or a carrot, you can store it in the root cellar?
Or you can leave them in the ground until it freezes.
Ah.
And my husband told me, I don't remember if it was last year or not, he's like, I'm not chipping carrots out of the frozen ground anymore.
They weren't that good, I take it.
So what we do with, like with beets, which, you know, a lot of countries call it beetroot because it is the root that we're eating. Although in the spring, you can eat the greens. You can make, there's actually a German dumpling that you wrap the beet leaf around before you cook it in the spring. But I love beets. Oh, my gosh. In the fall, my daughter loves beets. My granddaughter ate beets. And they're really, really good for you. But there are people in the world who have never tasted beets before.
Well, I've picked up a few products and looked at the labels lately, and beet juice is everywhere.
Right, because it's high in folate and nitrates, and it's a good antioxidant in addition to being high in fiber, of course.
It's in vegetable juice. It's in fruit juice. It's in lots of stuff.
They're trying to hide it because I think beets taste a little bit like dirt.
To me, they do.
That's what I've heard anyway. But, man, I'll tell you, if you've never had like grated beets, like raw grated beets with a little bit of onion and balsamic vinegar, oh, my gosh, you guys, that is so fabulous. But a lot of people, of course, will cook them first before they use them in a salad. And that's pretty simply cut that top off and put it in a pan and simmer it for a little bit till they're tender. And then put them in cold water and that skin on the outside just slips right off. And then you can eat them right there with butter on, which butter's good for you and beet's good for you. And so someday I'm thinking I could just eat buttered vegetables for the rest of my life and be really healthy.
Well, how about a big bowl of the world's most famous beet soup, borscht with some sour cream on top?
Gosh, that's amazing that you would bring that up because that is a traditional soup where I come from down in the Tri-County area of Emmons, Logan, and Stutzman. And, of course, this was like the end of the season. You had carrots, you had cabbage, you had beets. And what it was a Russian recipe that I think the Germans that migrated over here in the late 1800s kind of brought with them. And there are about as many ways to make borscht as there are people that love it, including making it with pickled beets so that you have that little bit of tang in there. So we didn't have sour cream growing up, so we put regular cream in and a little vinegar and kind of the same effect there.
Can you use golden beets, like basically as a straight up replacement? Because I feel like red beets you see a lot more often.
You do because people don't use the white ones because they don't look like a beet. But, you know, if you canned up white beets, pickled white beets and pickled red beets, you'd kind of have like a nice Christmas beet relish tray. But you know that the reds stain like crazy. And I like the white ones, too. But, yeah, that's the difference is the white ones aren't going to stain your counter while you're pickling them.
Or those red ones, you know, also it's a little bit like asparagus where sometimes you eat too much and then
you notice the difference. You call the nurse
and you're like, something's happening. And
yes. We want to warn all the newbies out there. If you're going to eat beets, do not panic if the next day you notice that your urine is a little on the pink side. It's perfectly normal. And like asparagus, I think that's what pulls toxins out of your body.
Now, you've, of course, told us about the joys of fermenting cabbage to make sauerkraut. So I can't imagine that you wouldn't like to ferment a beet.
Well, yes. And I have a Czechoslovakian friend that lives near Anamuse, and she makes beet kvass. And that is actually a lacto-fermented beet mixed with sea salt, and that is supposed to be an absolutely fantastically healthy drink, way more healthy than plain beet juice because you've also got those friendly probiotic bacteria, and it increases the vitamin levels of the beet. So fermentation is like a gift from God, you guys.
So what's lacto-fermented versus fermented?
I think that anything that's fermented is lacto is that bacteria.
Okay.
So that's lactic acid.
Does the fermenting. So, and I'm sure that it's just, we never called it that. You know, we never, ever thought of sauerkraut or pickled beets or fermented cucumbers as anything else but a nice complement to a good German sausage and fried potatoes, you know. And that's part of eating healthy is to have a balance between things like, yeah. you know, like they say smoked sausage is not so good for you. However, if you eat smoked sausage with a fermented food like sauerkraut or beets or cucumbers, then you're kind of like making it balanced and it's not as bad for you, which is why I think I have so many aunts and uncles that are still walking on the face of the earth.
They've eaten well and hearty.
Absolutely. And I have a 94-year-old aunt, and I wanted to take her out to lunch because she lives next to where I work. And I call her up, and she's like, yep, can't go today. I'm going to get my driver's license renewed. No way you're standing me up to get your driver's license. You're 94. You don't need a driver's license.
Congratulations, and welcome to North Dakota.
Holy cow.
Well, we check in with our food maven every week. Sue, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
We have John Chinesky to thank for my question today. John talked about accidentally getting hit by the bird in a cuckoo clock. And that got me wondering why we say clock someone to mean hit someone.
Why do they do that?
I bet you know.
I do know, and it's so great.
You're bouncing in your chair. Join us this week for Away With Words.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And who asks that question better than Marvin Gaye? We're going to look at our calendar of things to do this weekend. Eric Dethridge joins me here in our studio to talk about, you know, what we can entertain ourselves with.
Well, it's a good time of year to be entertained, Doug. And, you know, fall is upon us, you know, that time between summer and winter, you know, 2 weeks basically. And on Saturday, you can dress up, literally dress up the historic Comstock House in Moorhead for Halloween. From 1 to 4 p.m., carve up some pumpkins, make some decorations, put them up, and enjoy some tasty fall treats for your labor and your creativity. You'll get free admission and tours of the house. Decorate the historic Comstock House in Moorhead Saturday afternoon.
How about Frankenstein, the monster play? It's Friday through Sunday in Belfield at the Belfield Theater and Performance Center. It's alive! Dr. Frankenstein and his monster will be terrorizing the Belfield Theater. Are you brave enough to come and see them? This show is a dark comedy with excitement, chills, and lots of laughs. So it's a different kind of Frankenstein. Because of its intensity, though, it may not be suitable for young children. It's 7 o'clock on Friday and Saturday. It's 1:30 in the afternoon on Sunday. The cost of the tickets ranges from $10 to $15. This is Frankenstein, the monster play at the Belfield Theater and Performance Center.
I don't know why I'm thinking of Gene Wilder right about now there, Doug. At the Bell Mayhews in Bismarck, Saturday evening, the Bismarck Mandan Symphony performs Counts on Beethoven. Pianist Roger McVeigh returns to perform Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, a.k.a. the epic Emperor Concerto. Along with the music of Borrowed In, the orchestra will feature principal oboist Tanya Meritz, who will help honor the fallen heroes of World War I in Roman Cascarino's Blades of Grass. The BMSO's Count on Beethoven, Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Bell Mayhews. Tickets are $28.
How about the Minotaurus Trunk or Treat Tailgate? It's Saturday in Minot at the Mesa Arena. The Toros Trunk or Treat Tailgate is a fun event for all. You can dress the kids up, dress yourself up, deck your car out to win their ugly trophy. Kids get to trick or treat before the big game, be one of the first 100 kids to show up in costume, and they and one adult will get into the game free. The child must be accompanied by an adult. Free burgers and hot dogs donated by Casey Cope at Havig Insurance Agency. It's the Minotaurus Trunk or Treat Tailgate at the Mesa Arena in Minot on Saturday. It's at 7:30 in the evening, and it costs $10.
Jamestown, we didn't forget about you. You're getting in on the Halloween fun, too, on Saturday as the, of course, haunted Stutzman County Courthouse will be open to the public for a quote-unquote tour. Haunted one, I guess. There will be trick-or-treating throughout the historic site, and if you survive the dank, haunted basement, you'll get to enjoy some hot chocolate for your troubles. Halloween open house, 5 to 8 p.m. Saturday at the Stutzman County Courthouse and State Historic and Haunted Site. It is free, though there is a suggested donation of $5.
Halloween's getting to be a month-long festival. The Great Pumpkin Celebration is Saturday and Sunday in Grand Forks at Cabela's. If you're looking for spooktacular fun, you can join your friends at Cabela's over the weekend for their annual free Halloween event. There's something for everyone, from crafts to photos, trick-or-treating. Kids of all ages are invited to stop by and show off their costume. It runs from 12 until 5 in the afternoon on Saturday and Sunday, and it's free, unless, of course, you buy something at Cabela's.
And, Doug, this sounds very intriguing to me. In Dickinson on Saturday, you could take a journey to rural China and take in the folk sounds, ancient melodies, and captivating instruments of Manhu. These lively musicians from the remote Yunnan province in southwest China bring to life the traditions of the Yi people, an ethnic minority group with a rich musical history. Manhu from China, a World Fest concert, Saturday at 7 p.m. It's $10 for adults, $5 for seniors, kids, and DSU students.
Well, let's look at another part of the world, or listen to one. Nobuntu performs at MSU Moorhead on Saturday. That's right on the campus and the Gaty stage in the Roland Dill Center for the Arts. Nobuntu is a vocal quintet from Zimbabwe. They perform traditional folk songs, Afro jazz, and gospel. The performance is at 7:30 on Saturday evening. Again, it's at the Gaty stage in the Dill Center for the Arts, and the tickets range from $12 to $28. What's your pick this
week?
Well,
Doug, it's hard to believe that the sad, sad milestone is going on right now. It's been 20 years since University of Wyoming student Matthew Shepard was murdered. Of course, the story was turned into a movie, Boys Don't Cry. It also inspired the stage production, The Laramie Project, and that's taking the stage at Island Park in Fargo tonight through Saturday. This fascinating collection of community reactions explores the depths to which humanity can sink and the heights of compassion of which we are capable. It's poignant now as ever. The Laramie Project, tonight and Saturday at the stage in Island Park. Showtime is 7:30 p.m. Tickets range from $13 to $23.
Well, my pick is Silent Movie Night at the Fargo Theater. This is the 44th year of it or so. I mean, the first one was November 1974. Wow. It's Friday and Saturday in downtown Fargo at the Fargo Theater. The mighty Wurlitzer Theater pipe organ has helped recreate a classic silent film experience for this annual event. This year, the first act features the Fargo Theater Big Band All-Stars under the direction of David Ferreira, with singers and dancers performing to mid-20th century chart busters, some of them quite patriotic, and you might be asked to sing along. The second act features silent movie comedian Harold Lloyd in one of his best-known films, The Freshman, and Lance Johnson, who is the maestro at the mighty Wurlitzer Theater pipe organ at the Fargo Theater, the guy who rebuilt that organ, has worked on the one at Radio City Music Hall. He's well-known, highly regarded, and this is a big event if you like silent movies and big bands. Silent Movie Night at the Fargo Theater, Friday and Saturday in downtown Fargo, $17 for tickets at the door. And that's what's happening.
Dreams begin October 20th at the Hughes Fine Arts Center at the University of North Dakota. Aspiring young opera singers compete in the Metropolitan Opera North Dakota Manitoba District Auditions for the chance to progress to the regional competition and ultimately to New York. The competition begins at 11 a.m. Saturday, and singers will perform two opera arias. The event is open to the public. Master classes with nationally respected opera experts are Friday and Saturday. More at facebook.com/ndmbmetopera.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 18th. Dowsing is a term that means using a divining rod to find underground water. Dowsers look for water using a forked stick, usually a willow branch. Only a few people can locate water by dowsing, and most people have never witnessed it being done. It remains mysterious and is often dismissed as unscientific, a sleight of hand, or a falsehood. There have been a number of North Dakotans known for finding water by dowsing, including Stella Long, a woman from Epping, near Williston. Stella could apparently find underground water veins in semi-arid prairies where others had failed. Stella used a Y-shaped, 2-foot-long willow branch, tightly holding onto the forked branches and walking until the tip of the branch turned downward, indicating water down below. Born in 1899, Stella was about age 35 when she discovered her talent. She and her husband George were distraught when a flash flood destroyed the well on their farm south of Epping. The couple hauled water for 4 years, and then a relative urged them to try dowsing. As Stella later said, "I tried and found I could do it." She claimed she could also determine how far down the water was. For the next 45 years, Stella dowsed for people from Hinsdale, Montana to Grand Forks, charging a fee of $50. As she related, "Nobody's ever told me that I failed to find water for them." One time, a neighbor had dug 4 dry wells and finally asked Stella to douse. Stella said, "I found water," and he said he could have saved $500 if he'd asked me first. Stella Long did not know why or how dowsing worked, but said, "People have gifts. I didn't have good looks. I couldn't sing or dance, but God gave me this gift." She lived a long life, dying at age 94 in 1993. There have been plenty of doubters about dowsers. On this date in 1918, the Grand Forks Herald published a story about a U.S. Geological Survey pamphlet entitled "The Divining Rod," which discredited the ability of dowsers to trace underground streams or the depth at which water occurs. Nonetheless, as Stella said, "I've been accused of bending the willow down, but I don't. People just don't understand." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
Immigration authorities are raiding more and more American businesses.
It looked like something that you typically would see out of the movies, not something you ever plan on living out in real life.
The Trump administration is going after employers who hire undocumented workers.
This country will not survive if we don't straighten the way they can come over here and work.
Immigrant labor on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hear from Charles Tuttle. He's running for North Dakota's seat in the U.S. House of Representatives as an independent and in support of President Donald Trump. Chuck Lura will share a Natural North Dakota essay about leopard frogs on Friday. We'll have our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean will review another new movie, A Star Is Born, the 4th remake of that one. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.